Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, New Republic staff writer Alex Shepard joins me to discuss his piece, which explores the devolution of the Republicans' deficit hawkishness, comparing GOP opposition to stimulus spending under Biden to their more effective opposition under Obama.
And Heather Digby Parton will help me run down the biggest news stories of the week. Hey, become a member of this podcast over at ROFpodcast.com. It is your support that helps keep this show going. And don't forget, you can watch the interviews from the Ring of Fire podcast on the Majority Report YouTube channel. Head over to youtube.com/Sam Cedar, S-A-M-S-E-D-E-R. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and, of course, her very popular blog, Hullabaloo. So, Heather, this week we are, I think, the big news, at least this week, we are talking on Thursday, and on Friday it is expected that the House will pass the $1.9 trillion relief, COVID relief bill, and then it will go to the Senate. And the big question as of today, anyways, that is extant is, will the $15 minimum wage make it into the bill, make it past the parliamentarian? And it's been sort of fascinating to see how, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is trying to, push the Biden administration, particularly on the question of whether, Kamala Harris can overrule the parliamentarian. Just to give everybody, just to set this up so that we make sure that everybody's on the same page. Reconciliation is a specific process that has to do with passing legislation that specifically, by statute, deal with, have some direct implications for the federal budget. And if it meets that criteria, the bill only needs 50, a straight majority, 51%, if you include the vice president. And this bill is going to go through reconciliation process. They're going to have three bites at the reconciliation because of a fluke at the reconciliation process over the course of the next 2 years. Because it goes by fiscal year. And this one is actually for fiscal 2020, 2021. And so they're actually going to have two more reconciliation bills if they so deem. But a resolution is passed, and that was passed a couple of weeks ago, saying that we're going to spend $1.9 trillion, or at least that's how much it's going to affect the budget. So it could be, theoretically, it could be tax cuts, like it was under Republicans. In this instance, it's going to be expenditures. And so that's where we are today. What's your sense of how this is all going to go down?
Well, you know, my sense is that I heard Bernie Sanders talk this week on Chris Hayes, and I think he's kind. I mean, he's the chairman of the Budget Committee, so obviously he's extremely powerful in the Senate on this issue. And he said that it was either the $15 minimum wage, which of course he's backing. I mean, he's the guy who basically put it on the agenda in the first place, and he is, yeah, I don't see him backing down on this. But his view was, he told Chris, it's either going to be approved by the parliamentarian or it's going to require and go through reconciliation because of that, or it's going to require the elimination of the filibuster in order to pass it. Now, I thought that was really interesting because he did not say we can overrule it, you know, Kamala Harris can overrule it, which I, you know, was sort of thinking he would say, you know, let's push it. Let's get this thing done. We're in a position. We're going to do it. And that's certainly the progressive, you know, sort of stand on this so far. He did not say that. I mean, he basically said either the parliamentarian does it or the it goes through reconciliation, or it goes through reconciliation. Or they eliminate the filibuster.
Let me stop you there for 1 minute, because, you know, and maybe I saw a different clip, but my sense was he was responding to Chris Hayes saying, do you think this can pass the Senate on a straight vote? And he said, no, we can't get any Republicans. It's only going to pass via reconciliation or the end of the filibuster. I didn't hear him say anything about the parliamentarian about that, but maybe that was from a different part of the clip.
Maybe I misunderstood because that was how I came away from it. But maybe I was just reading that into it, him saying it'll pass through reconciliation, and he just wasn't addressing the parliamentarian aspect.
What was interesting? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going.
No, I was just going to.
Well, I was just going to add that on that same night, we're talking about Wednesday night, Ro Khanna and Pramila Jayapal appeared on those MSNBC primetime shows. And Ro Khanna said, look, we know that she can overrule the parliamentarian. If you don't want the $15 minimum wage, then make that argument. But we know that she can. And then Pramila Jayapal appeared on O'Donnell's program and said something similar, like, we can't tell people 2 years from now that you don't have a $15 minimum wage because of the unelected parliamentarian. That's just not going to fly. And it's not a direct quote, but it's pretty close as to what she said. And so I found that interesting that there was an all out sort of like maybe a 1-2 punch there, right? Bernie Sanders saying we either got to get rid of the filibuster, which it sounds like it's going to be, you know, I don't think that's going to happen, or at least not for something, you know, that is going to be that something like the $15 minimum wage. I think it's possible we may see reform for voting rights, or it goes through reconciliation. And I think they're basically setting up a scenario where it's like, we're not going to have excuses. We're either going to pass this by hook or crook or not.
Well, if that's the case, and you know, you may very well be right, and I agree with you that is the progressive approach to this, which is like, you know, come on, you've got the power, you have to go for it. And I think they have the right side of the argument, because we're in an emergency situation, and this is the time for Democrats to, you know, push hard for this kind of thing. And it's popular. It just passed in Florida, for crying out loud. Yeah. I mean, this is not something that, you know, and it's not like that just, you know, they lower the boom and suddenly overnight everybody has a $15 minimum, federal minimum wage. This is, it you know, unfolds over time. And you know, there's no reason that people can't adjust to it. You know, I think that it's perfectly fine. I also think that just on a purely raw political level, that having Harris step in on that, right here at the beginning of the Biden administration, and saying, look, you know, you people, you can play your games over here. You can talk about, you know, people's bad tweets, and you can, you know, insult transgender appointees, and you can play your little culture war games. We're not playing games. We are going to get this stuff done. You are in the wrong. This is popular. We are going for it. And I think a show of strength like that, I mean, maybe I'm just, you know, buying into some, you know, weird old fashioned sort of view of how things are done. But I just don't see how you can deal with people like these Republicans without a show of strength, because they're just not responsive to anything else. They're entirely shameless. They have no, I mean, look at the hypocrisy on display every single day. You know, these people who, you know, basically, you know, fall at the feet of Donald Trump complaining about civility. I mean, it's ridiculous. So right. You can't deal with people like that by acting as though they are operating in good faith. What you have to do is say, look, you don't want to negotiate with us in good faith. That's obvious. They sent 10 senators up to the White House. At least 5 of them were never going to vote for this COVID relief bill. And we knew that. So there was no way they could break the filibuster. That wasn't going to happen. So they're basically, you know, demanding you break the filibuster, you do this, you'd overrule the parliamentarian, you do this sort of thing, because they have left us no choice. They have left the Democrats no choice but to do that if they want to save the country. I mean, we are in deep, deep trouble, and everybody knows that. And you know, they have to show that they're not going to be rolled this time. It's that Lucy in the football thing, right? I mean, every single time, yes, let's meet halfway and we'll compromise and unity and bipartisanship, et cetera, and then boom. You know, they pull the rug out from under. So, you know, I think that it would be a smart political move as well as, you know, obviously a great policy move. Just get this thing, you know, get it done, get it through, get this thing moving so that people get checks in the mail and we start, you know, the schools can be opened and all this stuff that needs to happen as quickly as possible. So I'm hopeful, you know, if Bernie, see, I was surprised because the way I interpreted Sanders, I was thinking, well, basically he's thinking we're going to have to break the filibuster to do this. And I, like you, I don't think that this is an issue that they can break the filibuster
no.
over. It's just not a big enough, you know, sort of, I mean, it is, it's a huge issue. It's meaningful. It's everything, but it doesn't have the expansive sort of moral component that voting rights and also just basic survival of the Democratic Party involved in it. I mean, if they don't do it for voting rights, well, they're signing their own death warrant. So they, you know, I can see that being the vehicle for breaking the filibuster, but, you know, if he's not doing that, if they're prepared to push that, then I hope that they do. And then we don't know whether the parliamentarian's going to overrule it or not. I mean, we still hasn't been decided. So we may be, this may be a totally moot point.
That's right. That's right. I certainly hope it will be. And I think, just to explain, and we'll circle back because I want to talk about this a little bit more, but what I anticipate for something like voting rights is some type of bill that creates the best I can make the analogy is a reform to the filibuster that anything that deals with voting rights only needs 51 votes. I mean, something like that. Yeah. I would anticipate, and it would be harder to craft something like that for a $5 for a $15 minimum wage. But you know what's interesting is, I really am having trouble, just sort of like wrapping my head around what, I can imagine on one hand that maybe they think it's going to be a hard sell to Joe Manchin to get the $15 minimum wage, and maybe that's why they're not, they're maybe in some way hoping that it doesn't make it into the bill, but. You know, there was a couple of, and it was very performative. Well, it's always performative, but it seemed very sort of like mailed in. John Thune yesterday got out and said, you know, when I was 16, I had a job for $6 an hour. And then everybody pointed out online by going to the inflation calculator that, dude, you got paid $27 an hour. in today's dollars. Like there was no, you know, like, that's the kind of thing you do if you're not really taking an argument seriously, right? Like we should really vet this. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to claim that I got paid less than, you know, maybe somebody should do an apples to apples comparison, before I go out there and make an ass of myself. And I think like my point being that, and you and I have been making this point for the past couple, any real, like, substantive opposition to this. Right. I mean, Joe Manchin has said he wants $11 minimum wage as opposed to, you know, like, and I think Mitt Romney said maybe $10. But I mean, you could easily just say like, OK, well, if you're really concerned about that, let's pass we'll pass an amendment. We'll enter an amendment. $11 for West Virginia and maybe $11 for Arizona. And you guys can vote on that. And the rest of the country will get 15. And you can go back to your state and say, like, look, guys. I was able to secure you a $4 an hour less minimum wage. Aren't you happy you elected me? I mean, you can put him in that type of situation. But I for the life of me, don't understand the theory behind not having Kamala Harris overrule the parliamentarian if it comes down to that. I mean, it's not like it hasn't happened before. It happened in 1975. So it's not like, you know, you need to go back to Reconstruction or pre-Civil War. You know, 1975 is modern times. And in fact, one could argue, you know, a far more dramatic thing to do than in this day and age where things are so hopelessly gridlocked. And you don't. I mean, everyone understands you don't have a legislative partner on the other side. And this is the type of thing, you know, I mean, look, we could sit here and debate about the $2,000 check, right? I mean, the fact is that when Joe Biden made the promise for the $2,000 check, the $600 check had already passed. So he said $2,000. I don't see how you keep your left flank if you don't make this $15 minimum wage happen and you're the Biden administration. You know, this is a bill, and you said it was popular. I mean, we need to be explicit about this. It has 75% approval rating, the bill does, the $1.9 trillion from the country. 60% of Republicans either strongly or somewhat favor this bill. I mean, that's astonishing. I don't even think you get those numbers for people who want to take the vaccine at this point. Like, that's, I mean, it really is amazing.
You don't. You don't. And of course, you know, the fact is that they do not have to, you know, compromise, right? I mean, it's only in the Congress here where they're doing this thing where, you know, we really, it's 50-50 and it's a polarized country and we really need to, you know, to have a little give and take here, et cetera, et cetera. Like you said, 75% of the country wants this bill to pass. That this is 25% of, you know, the looniest Trump voters are the only people who don't want this thing to pass. And yet the Republicans in the Congress, I mean, if you were to just reflect a, you know, an allegedly polarized country, you would have 25 Republicans on board for this thing, right? I mean, that'd be 20, that'd be, you know, that number. So, I mean, this is ridiculous that they're even having to do this. And a lot of this is performative. And that's one reason why it sort of worries me about the $15 thing, because Biden came out and said, I don't think it's going to make it, which was a terrible thing to say. And I'm not sure even why he said it or what that was about. But, you know, this idea somehow that, well, you know, we have to sacrifice something. And, you know, the good news is that he did come out and he said today, Thursday, that he, you know, he threw it back at the Republicans, said, what do you want to get rid of? What is, you know, they said, you know, is he going to compromise? And he goes, well, you tell me, what is it you think, what is it you want me to take out of the bill? Assuming that because all the elements of the bill are popular, it's not just the bill as a whole, it's that everything in it is popular, including the $15, you know, minimum wage, that I think, you know, hopefully that he's, you know, thought better of doing some kind of negotiating, right, in a Q&A somewhere. And, you know, and the point is that, I mean, so far they've kept it together and said, look, 1.9, that's where we are. That's just the number we came up with in order to fulfill the needs that have to be in this bill. We didn't pick the number first. We picked the needs, and that's what it came out to be. That's a very smart way to look at it instead of the way the Obama people did, by, you know, doing this cutoff that, you know, we can't go over a trillion. And that was just stupid. You know, that ended up being a, you know, short selling the stimulus bill in 2009. And they learned from that, and they aren't framing that the issue that way. But the thing is that, you know, this thing is popular and the number doesn't mean anything. Nobody cares about that. They don't even, it's so abstract, yes, that, you know, an average person doesn't care about it. And if they can pass this thing, what that means is that they, you know, aside from just delivering material needs to the American people, it will mean that, you know, we've moved past this idea where unity means bipartisanship in the U.S. Senate that's 50-50, right? I mean, for nobody talking about bipartisanship in the House. That's not really an issue. I mean, once in a while, a couple float over or float back. But, you know, that's not, everybody knows that's a party line. You know, that's a party line vote that's going to happen in there. And that's fine. But the idea here that somehow or another, because there's 50 senators, which we know is undemocratic anyway, and represent far fewer people than the 50 Democratic senators, that represents unity, that represents bipartisanship. You know, it's ridiculous. And I am glad to see I saw Ron Klain going out there, and he's been the one who's been pushing this, that we're talking about unifying the country. These people are going to do what they want to do here in Washington, but we're trying to unify the country. And as long as they keep doing that, then they should just push it and use whatever tools they have at their disposal. Because, you know, if there's one thing that the Republicans have shown us, you know, let's look at, go look at Mitch McConnell's face and say, you're going to lecture us about breaking norms and breaking rules and changing traditions after what you just did. You installed the Supreme Court justice in the, you know, the final 6 weeks of an election. You with after having, you know, refused to seat one 8 months before an election. Sorry, dude. You know that you have to live with the norm breaking that you began. And now we had now you've left us with this huge mess and we're going to have to clean it up. And if you won't help us, then we're going to use whatever tools we have at our disposal.
Yeah, I just and Klain was on, I think, MSNBC last night, too. I mean, they all were out there, right? I mean, making their case, saying that he did not they were not going to overrule the parliamentarian. I mean, that's what they're saying anyways. And that may be the case. I just I mean, it really does beg the question, like who what constituency do they feel that they are serving by not doing that? I mean, it must be just Joe Biden saying, like, you know, being either it's one of two things, right? It's just like some bizarre institutionalism that is self-defeating. I mean, hugely self-defeating and also, you know, incredibly detrimental to the American public. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, you know, John Thune actually, you know, made the case when he went out there and he said, like, I made $6 an hour. You made $27 an hour in today's dollars. You're saying that, you know, you were able to pull yourself by your bootstraps by making $27 an hour. You got people out there making $20 less an hour than that now. And that's just, I mean, there is a real need to deal with this at this point. And it's just not, there's just not going to be another opportunity for it, I don't think. I mean, if it doesn't happen now, it's hard to know when it's going to happen. So it's either one of two things, that for Joe Biden, the value of the institution is that much more important than getting this done. And by the value of the institution, I'm talking about like an arcane rule, right? I mean, the parliamentarian is not elected. And it really is a function of like, well, we just happen to have this parliamentarian as opposed to that parliamentarian. And
right. It's not like she's the Oracle of Delphi.
I mean, this is not like a position that's been passed down through, you know, generations, from, you know, a mother to mother to, you know, to child, mother to daughter, you know, and like, you know, they're part of some type of long, you know, priesthood. It's just, yeah, she was hired as parliamentarian. This is her perspective and that's it. You know, and if she says, yeah, it should be in the bill, nobody's going to remember this in 6 weeks. That she said that, right? I mean, nobody. Or it's that the Biden administration doesn't want there to be a $15 minimum wage, and for whatever reason, and so this is, I think, this to me, and you could argue the $1,400 check thing is, but when I think of when things started to go south, in terms of my perspective of the Obama administration, to be fair, you know, there wasn't many of us. I suspect you were one of them. We would talk quite a bit about the Obama administration wanting to cut Social Security. But I started to really, really give up the ghost with the bankruptcy cram down. Now, Joe Biden's already had his honeymoon. This is it, right? Like, I mean, this is it. And, you know, he'll get some, they're doing a great job with COVID. He'll get some benefit out of it. He'll get some benefit. I suspect that we're going to, if we do have 70% of the country vaccinated by June or July, I think by the time we get to September, we're going to see a huge economic boon. There's a big pent up demand and that's certainly going to help, in the midterms. But, I think this is a really important marker for the Biden administration. And it's just very difficult for me to see the downsides. Like, who are they afraid of alienating? You know, there is, you know, like you say, this weekend, Donald Trump is going to announce, and just like even just, you know, I'm phrasing it this way because this is the way it's been phrased. Donald Trump is going to announce that it's still his Republican Party. And the amazing thing about it is Mitt Romney has already capitulated. Like to the extent that there's any other part of the Republican Party, they have already said, if Donald Trump wants it, it's his. And we can't do anything about it. And so, you know, they're not on the playing field of policy. They're not making any argument. It is wholly irrelevant what the Democrats do in terms of like the concept of, you know, big government or excess or whatever it is that they, whatever the boogie words in their head that they're afraid of being deployed. It's totally irrelevant to their political fortunes. And so I think it's very, very dangerous for the Biden administration to not follow through on what they have ostensibly said that they want.
You know, one thing I wonder, have you, I mean, I honestly, and maybe this is my fault, I haven't researched it enough. Where are the, you know, the spoilers on this? Manchin, Sinema, the rest on the $15. I mean, have they expressed?
Manchin has said that he is going to introduce an $11, he's going to introduce an amendment. If it, you know, if it's in the bill, he's going to introduce an amendment to make it $11 an hour. Sinema, I'm less clear on where she's at. Now, you know, if you offer up an $11 minimum wage, you are acknowledging that the minimum wage needs to be raised, and it puts him in a position of saying, look, I tried to go it down, but the minimum wage definitely needs to be raised, and it's all or nothing, and he could, you know, Manchin can justify the vote. The idea that Kristen Sinema would be the single vote to sink the COVID bill because of the minimum wage. I mean, that would take a level of political, I want to say, I don't want to say courage, but I mean, I think insanity. Yeah, chutzpah is probably the better word. Like, you really want to be the person I mean, that's the thing is that how do you vote against the $1.9 trillion because you don't want people to get a $15 minimum wage? That is a very, very difficult lift, it seems to me, if you're a Democrat. I mean,
that's right. And when you look back at what happened, and this is instructive too, which I'm sure Klain remembers and Biden probably remembers too. You know, they went through this with Obamacare when they were trying to pass this. And they ended up, of course, as we all recall, going through a reconciliation. And I remember having a bet with somebody. They're saying, well, there's no way that somebody who didn't vote for the original bill and it goes through reconciliation. Because at that time, of course, the Democrats had a bunch of, they had like 59 votes, right, when the thing first went through. If they don't vote for it, then when it comes back to reconciliation, they can't vote for it again, or maybe it was the other way around. In any case, you know, there is absolutely no way that that applies. What you're talking about with Manchin is very, very likely. He could easily say, you know, I'm against a $15 minimum wage and I'm just not. He could even be much more adamant about it.
Of course.
But when push comes to shove and you're in reconciliation and this is the bill and this is the whole enchilada is resting on it. At that point, within reconciliation, they start to talk it over. It is highly unlikely that Manchin's going to sink that COVID relief bill either. I don't see that happening. So they have to get to reconciliation. And once they get there, whatever Sinema and Manchin, whatever noises they're making, I think are going to be irrelevant. I don't see either one of them wrecking that. I mean, that's the destruction of the Biden presidency right there.
I mean,
it's done. You know, might as well just pack up your gear and go home.
I don't know how you go home to your constituents and say, I just sunk all the funding for unemployment, for schools, for hospitals, because I was really worried about low wage workers getting $15. I just don't see how that happens. And I think that is, you know, I don't see how that happens. And now maybe I'm being too generous here. Maybe the Biden administration is like, it's one thing for Manchin and Sinema to vote for this bill, you know, if the parliamentarian says it's got to be in the bill, it's another if this becomes not the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bailout, but rather the Kamala Harris cooked up, you know, surprise or something because she overruled the parliamentarian. But like, if that is actually their fear, it is, I don't know. I mean, it's like, it's the functional equivalent of, you know, being afraid of like, the dominoes theory at this point. Like, honestly, it just seems so arcane and absurd. This is not a Republican Party that has the, apparatus to make these type of arguments anymore. You know, they can't go on to the Sunday morning talk show and say like, this is an outrage. Like, honestly, like even now, like, you know, there's still going to be some holdovers, but most people are just going to go, even the ones that we think are the worst of the worst. And I have anybody in mind, but like, you know, the sort of like the beltway media types, even nobody cares about them anymore. I mean, it's just like a completely different media landscape, it seems like.
I think you're right. And I think that it's absurd to think about that anyway. I mean, look, everything rises and falls on this. I mean, this is the big bill. It is $1.9 trillion. It's huge. It is it's COVID rescue. It's stimulus. It is setting the table for everything that the Biden administration is going to do. If they need to pass it no matter what. And the $15 minimum wage in there will it's such a throwaway for the kind of purposes that they're talking about. It makes no sense to throw it away. It means everything to the Democratic base, and it means nothing to Republicans. And it will mean absolutely nothing in terms of, I mean, they get nothing out of that, right? I mean, there is no upside, as you've said. The downside is huge. And breaking the rule, as I said earlier, and, you know, the tradition, basically, the rule's always been there that the president of the Senate can overrule the parliamentarian. That sends a strong message that we're not playing your games. Yeah. Because the Republicans, you know, the stuff that they're throwing out there is absurd. Their arguments against the bill are ridiculous. They're terrified of having to run in 2022 with a booming economy and a record of achievement of, you know, material, gain for the American people at the hands of Joe Biden. They don't want to run against this bill. They're going to do it because they have no choice. I mean, they're going to object to it. You know, it's 100% obstruction. We're already seeing, you know, our hero Mitt Romney step up and, you know, make a fool of himself on that. So they're going to go with that, but they don't want to. They'd love it if the Democrats could just crash the thing.
Yep.
And certainly they'd love to have a little, you know, having their little $15 an hour scalp. I mean, that's kind of pathetic, if you ask me. I mean, that's ridiculous. They're going to run and say, well, maybe Biden revived the entire economy and brought us through COVID. And maybe all that happened. We've got a big infrastructure program going now, but you know, we didn't let them have that $15 minimum wage. I mean, really, is that going to be their argument? I mean, it's absurd. So there's no point in it. It's ridiculous. I don't even know why Manchin's, you know, or any of them.
Oh, well, Manchin, I have to say that like Manchin, it's almost like refreshing how simplistic his formula is. I mean, I think like, you know, for Manchin, it is, I need to show that I buck the Democrats, even if in the end I vote for the main, you know, sort of the meat and potatoes. Look at me. I was the one who sent back the lemonade. And I said, I'm not, you know, like, yeah. Or they brought me ketchup and I said, I want hot sauce. That's the type of renegade I am. And then after that, all I think he cares about is, you know, just promise me that there'll be a ton of money for fuel subsidies, for fossil fuel subsidies. But on everything else, I think it's completely, I have a performance to make, and that's my performance. My brand is this. And I think Kristen Sinema is very similar to that. I think, you know, she's trying to be the, you know, on some level, like, I think she's trying to be the John McCain of the Democratic Party. And, you know, in the end, John McCain voted with Republicans all the time, except for the one time he crashed the ACA. And I think that was because, you know, Donald Trump was heavily invested in and basically said, like, you know, I have no respect for John McCain for, you know, being a prisoner of war. And I think John McCain took that personally, as John McCain was like to do. And so there it is. I mean, it'll be fascinating to see. Like, I just hope we don't get into that position. Fingers crossed. Let's hope the parliamentarian does the right thing. Look, the fact is, no matter whose study you accept, and whether it says it adds revenue or it creates a deficit, there has never been a study that has been published about the minimum wage that doesn't, if you want to assess it on one narrow plane, there's never been a study that has been released that says this does not affect the U.S. budget.
Right.
It does. And
of course it does. And taxes.
Yeah.
People who make more money pay taxes. I mean, duh. It's just, I don't even understand. Honestly, I'm surprised that this is even an issue. This one seems totally obvious to me.
Yep.
As having an impact.
All right. Well, listen, we just got a couple of minutes left here. Let's just talk about this other thing, this nascent January 6th commission. We've been hearing, you know, really conflicting testimony, it seems to me, this week about from various Capitol Police officials and whatnot as to, you know, what went wrong, what did they know, when did they know it, what did they anticipate. Nancy Pelosi wants to have a bipartisan commission, but one that had 7 Democrats and 4 Republicans. Mitch McConnell said he's not interested in that. Chris Coons came out and said, I think we should have equal amount of Republicans and Democrats, but we can't have any elected officials. We can't have anybody who has any type of electoral stakes in it, which I am not one to give Chris Coons credit at any point. But, you know, let's face it, anybody who doesn't have any Republican who does not have an electoral stake in the Republican Party is probably a never Trumper. Right. I mean, or I should say,
yeah.
You know, it's maybe not every dog is a German Shepherd, but every German Shepherd is a dog. You know, nobody who has an electoral stake in the Republican Party is a never Trumper. Let's put it that way. And so the chances of getting, you know, you put 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, the chances of a couple of those Republicans just being anti-Trump and seeing this as a way of reformation of the Republican Party, I think it's pretty high. It won't help. I mean, it won't, you know, I think Mitt Romney has it right. But what's your sense of this whole thing? I mean, I think it's really vitally important.
It's vitally important. There's just no doubt about it. Something, and in fact, the testimony this week just made that more obvious than it even was before. Something went very wrong there, just on that level alone. Of the intelligence that was, you know, it's like after 9/11, which is, you know, how could this happen? There was intelligence, and the right people didn't get it. What was the delay? What, you know, what went on there? I mean, this is, you know, it has to be investigated, and investigated in a way that has some kind of credibility with the American people. And that's really hard to do right now. Yeah. Because of, you know, the intense partisanship. And particularly this Republican, you know, I don't know who you could find in the Congress, in the House of Representatives that would be, you know, that would be credible enough to people. So I think Coons is onto something. And in fact, that's what they did with the 9/11 Commission. They called in some, you know, some gray beards and some elder statesmen. And there have to be some people like that out there who could do this. I don't know who, but I'm sure that there's a list of people that you could bring in to do this thing. And they have to be given the power to, you know, they have to be given subpoena power. They have to be able to take the investigation wherever it goes. Now, the big problem here is that you've got Mitch McConnell out there now, and he stuck his nose into it, saying that, you know, if we're going to look into anything but the very, very, very little narrow thing that happened on January 6th, it's just that one day and nothing else. We can't go back and look at any of the stuff, or certainly not examine the big lie, which he himself has said was a big lie and, you know, has gone on record. We can't look at that. But if you want to, what we need to do then is we're going to look at the Black Lives Matter protests and what happened in Portland over the summer and expand the reach so that we look at all of the, quote, political violence in this country. Well, that's, of course, ridiculous. They have nothing to do with one another, except to the extent of looking maybe at the way the authorities respond to the two of them. And I don't think Mitch McConnell's going to like the way that comes out. And, you know, this is just another way of obstructing the whole idea. And it's pretty clear to me that the Republicans, they know what happened. We know what happened. We don't have the details. We don't know the individuals involved. But we do know the overarching story here is that Donald Trump incited an insurrection based on a huge lie about losing the election. And he got people worked up into a frenzy so that they went and stormed the Capitol and went hunting for Nancy Pelosi and Mike Pence. We know that. And he does not want there to be any kind of a credible investigation that looks into the whole thing that happened there, because we know how bad that makes him and his party look, because they're still supporting the guy who did it. I mean, I think if they had, you know, decided to, after this whole thing, if the party as a whole had said, all right, enough, we're done with Trump, we're not going to do it this anymore. If his followers out in the country had said, whoa, that's a bit too far for me, assaulting the Capitol, that's not something I can go along with. If that had happened, maybe they'd be able to take a look at it. But because Trump is still the leader of the Republican Party, I'll be very surprised if they get anything done. Honestly, I am now kind of pessimistic about it, to be frank.
Well, I think that is well-founded. Heather Parton, Digby, always a pleasure. We'll be back next week. And I imagine, we're going to have at least some clarity on what's going to happen with this COVID relief bill. That's for sure. And that is going to be, I think, I think we're going to remember this week when we look back on the Biden presidency for a long time.
Agreed.
Heather, as always, a pleasure. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Heather Parton is a weekly contributor to Ring of Fire Radio. You can find her writings over at Salon.com and the popular blog Hullabaloo. Now I'm going to hand the show over to our new Ring of Fire co-host. I almost can't say that anymore. Emma Vigeland.
Thanks, Sam. Hello, everyone. I am joined by Alex Shepard, who is a staff writer at The New Republic, one of my favorite publications. He wrote a piece yesterday, I believe, or 2 days ago, called No One's Buying the Republicans' Deficit Fearmongering Anymore. Alex, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to talk about your piece because you really articulated the noticeable shift that I guess I'd been kind of experiencing or feeling in terms of the public discourse surrounding Biden's stimulus package, as opposed to what we saw in the wake of the financial collapse in 2008 as Obama entered office. So can you give a broad strokes vision of what you wrote about, and then we can get into more of the specifics?
Yeah, it's basically what we're seeing right now with McConnell and particularly Steve Scalise in the House GOP is Republicans trying to kind of wind back the clock to early 2009, making the case that any effort that Democrats take to fight back against sort of economic collapse that we've seen over the last year, you know, puts us on the road to serfdom, that it raises the deficit, that it, casts our children and grandchildren in this sort of bondage of debt. And that in 2009 really worked. I think you saw this huge opposition to what was a very, you know, sensible, and I think now most people agree, too small bailout of around, you know, $780 billion. And no Republicans voted for it. And then, you know, 2 weeks after that passed, you had the Tea Party start, and basically the next 8 years were just dominated by deficit reduction talk. Right now, there's an attempt to kind of, you know, get the band back together, start playing these old hits again. But nobody cares anymore. I think one of the weird things that happened, you know, over the last 4 years is that Republicans as the party of fiscal responsibility and fiscal seriousness, you know, the Republican base doesn't buy it anymore. But I think also the Beltway media, who was its most, you know, kind of credulous, the most credulous cheerleaders of this myth, everyone is kind of rolling their eyes now.
So how much of that has to do with Republicans' own actions? Because obviously we saw them pass these massive tax cuts through reconciliation in the Trump era, which ballooned the deficit and debt to much higher than it was. And so they avoided questions or really didn't talk about the deficit at all. And then, of course, when there's a Democrat in office, these concerns reemerge. How much of that affects the media coverage of it and the narrative surrounding it? And then also subsequently, really where the Beltway media goes, Democrats often go, how that affects the Democrats' actions. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, so I mean, Republicans have gotten away with this grift for, you know, decades at this point, right? Reagan came in as a small government conservative and the deficits ballooned. Military spending increased, tax cuts for the rich happened. This happened again with George W. Bush and the Iraq War. Also, we had more tax cuts for the rich. And then finally, again, Donald Trump and more, this time $1.9 trillion, most of which went to corporations and the wealthiest Americans. So I think on the one hand, Republicans probably have looked at this and said, look, we've gotten away with this trick again and again. People see us as the party of small government, even though we always grow the deficit. We don't do anything to cut the deficit. The only time that we've had a balanced budget, you know, in the last 40 years has been under a Democrat. But I think one big thing that changed was that Donald Trump just stopped paying lip service to these kind of bromides of conservatism. He stopped saying the stuff that was always frankly untrue about how we needed to shrink the government. And he also ran in 2016 sort of against a lot of these ideas. They're very unpopular. Certainly when you would go and talk to people in the Tea Party back in 2010, he came away with a much more complex vision of what they were thinking. It wasn't necessarily that they were, you know, let's shrink the government so we can drown it in a bathtub types like Grover Norquist. What they wanted was more akin to what Trump was saying, that, you know, the government should bestow benefits on people who deserve them, which I think in the case of the Tea Party, in the case of Trump Republicans, meant, you know, white people who pay their taxes. And what we've seen since then, I think, is this kind of alignment where Trump has taken over the party. There's no one like Paul Ryan left to kind of claim to be, you know, sort of beat the Bible, which is Atlas Shrugged in this case, and say, we're taking all this stuff seriously. So instead, you have this huge void where the GOP used to say that they had the kind of fiscal policy. That party was about low taxes and, you know, skeletal benefits for the poor. Now, I'm not really sure what they have aside from the kind of, you know, nativist rhetoric from Trump. You have the kind of owning the libs style of Republicanism from Madison Cawthorn et al. But now when McConnell and Steve Scalise say, well, you know, this bill is too big, you know, people can point to, you know, at this point, 40 years of Republican legislation that contradicts them.
I want to talk about Trump and his role in this as well, because you open your piece talking about how basically the Republican Party misses Donald Trump's marketing ability. When you said that it really just struck a chord with me, because look, we've been saying it for years, in progressive media, Donald Trump really is an expert marketer, but a lot of what he was pushing forward, as you discuss, was not aligned so much with the GOP orthodoxy. So do you draw a lot of the media not buying what the Republicans are selling and the Democrats subsequently? Do you draw that a lot of that back to Donald Trump just indelibly changing the conversation surrounding the modern Republican Party of, you know, the extreme Republican Party that we've seen for the past few decades?
Yeah, I mean, he can sort of scramble that conversation. I think you saw that with when he passed this corporate tax cut bill that was, you know, it was GOP orthodoxy 101. It was not at all what Trump had campaigned on in 2016, which was a kind of more expansive government. He was sort of running against the kind of perception that Republicans, you know, only cared about elites. Suddenly he's doing this tax cut bill that is, you know, it's pure trickle down, right? It's all corporate tax cuts and tax cuts for rich people. And he acts as if he's invented trickle down economics, which is obviously insane. But I think it did at least confuse the media. Well, on the one hand, you still had the sort of older Republican hands like Mitch McConnell, who could pitch the same old lines. And you had Trump, who was being presented as this kind of new model of, you know, sort of populist conservatism. And setting aside whether or not that's true or not, I think it did prevent particularly the kind of standard Beltway media types from really figuring out what was going on. And now I think that the Republicans are trying to just roll back the clock again and act almost as if Donald Trump never happened, as if he didn't exist anymore. It's not working, I think, in large part because there isn't a larger sort of groundswell of Republican policy ideas at the moment. This is, I think, been true for a while, but folks like Paul Ryan could go and brand themselves as the young guns. They were the new policy shop for Republicanism. They're really just sort of buffering old Jack Kemp ideas, but it worked. And now, you know, we know who the stars of the party are now, right? It's folks like Madison Cawthorn, it's Lauren Boebert. These are people who, you know, aren't talking about the top marginal tax rates, right? They're not talking about broadening the base. They're talking about how they should be allowed to carry guns in the Capitol.
Yeah. I mean, it's a cultural war in that sense, which obviously the donors aren't that interested in that. They could do without all of those things as long as they're able to get their tax cuts. So that's primarily what they're interested in. And so I would imagine they're quite disheartened by what they've seen the Republican Party being unable to communicate this message effectively so that they can get the end result. But I'm curious too, just to quickly divert, what you think is the source behind people like Larry Summers not being taken seriously anymore? Because, you know, we're talking largely about the Republican Party, but the call was coming from inside the House in the Obama era when we were talking about stimulus in 2008, or 2009, really. Because Larry Summers was a part of the Obama orbit, and he's now still saying that Biden needs to go smaller on stimulus, but yet he's not really being listened to. So what about the deficit hawks of the Democratic Party as well?
I mean, I think that there's a sort of boring answer and a more exciting political answer. The boring answer is that fiscal policy has started to bewilder people more, and that I think people thought that they knew what was happening 12 years ago. And if you sort of pumped all this money into the economy, the fear was that there would be huge runaway inflation like we had several decades ago, and, you know, politicians have been terrified of inflation. Since that didn't happen, I think there's been a lot more comfort with, you know, making the money machine go burr, or, you know, flooding the economy when it was necessary. I think the more interesting idea, too, though, is that as that happened, there was this recognition of what a lot of people had correctly been saying for a long time, which is that small government conservatism was not actually about deficit reduction. It was about cutting benefits for poor people mostly. And that, you know, whenever Republicans like Ronald Reagan took charge, what they would do is cut welfare benefits, but they would increase military spending and they would cut taxes for the rich. That's not fiscal policy, right? Like, that's politics, but it's not designed to actually help the economy. Democrats were held hostage to this idea that they were the party of free handouts, that they were the party of welfare queens, and they were terrified of being labeled as such because they looked at, you know, the 1980s and early 1990s and decided that they couldn't win that way. Well, now we have this entirely scrambled political world in which inflation, you know, knock on wood, seems to be kept at bay, even as the Fed has poured trillions of dollars into the economy over the last few years, but also where both parties are sort of acting like Santa Claus. You've got Donald Trump, who, you know, I think came very close to winning the election in large part because he just gave people free money. And Democrats are looking at this now and seeing that there's a lot of political benefit in universal handouts. I mean, that not enough apparently to give people $2,000, but that's still a market difference from where we were just a decade ago.
Well, they won the Georgia runoffs because of that reason. Yes, that's a whole different conversation on the bizarre decision to market yourself as $2,000 checks when you really only plan on giving $1,400. But I digress. So I also thought this was a great point in your piece about how Republicans are unable to use the winners and losers dynamic when talking about who gets handouts, you know, to put it colloquially, in this the stimulus package in the pandemic versus when it was just the economic collapse in the Great Recession. Can you talk about how those narratives differ?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting to look back at 2009 and at Rick Santelli, who sort of kicked off the Tea Party on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, basically did this huge speech that, again, is remembered as being the sort of restart of or reinvigoration of small government conservatism. But it wasn't really about that at all. It was all about how Rick Santelli and his rich, you know, stock trading buddies shouldn't have to bail out, you know, idiots who took out loans that were too big. That it was this idea that, you know, there were winners and losers, or, you know, makers and takers, the 53% and the 47%. This was this huge idea that I think grew out of, I think, a really sociopathic response to the housing market collapse, but it was essentially Republican orthodoxy. And it carried through most of the way that they talked about fiscal policy as well, that the government shouldn't be there to bail out people who make, you know, foolish decisions. Well, one problem with what's happened over the last 14, 15 months is that you can't really blame anybody for it. I think it really scrambles this idea that's animated, you know, right-wing and conservative policymaking for, you know, since the 1960s, really, which is that, you know, there are people that just can't make it, that they're too lazy, that they don't work hard enough, that they're not willing to do what it takes to succeed, and that it's not your responsibility to help those people. Well, you know, we've been in the middle of a global pandemic that I think has really affected, it's affected everyone, and it's also affected everyone unfairly, right? It affects people unfairly in the way that life has always affected people unfairly. But you can't go around and say these, you know, people took out, you know, COVID loans unfairly, or, you know, whatever the version would be. It's really a crisis that requires universal policymaking. And the sort of conservatism, you know, whether of the small C variety or the right wing, you know, cultural variety, it's just not really well equipped to deal with that kind of crisis.
Right. And you know, you also mentioned in your piece, which I think is really important for people to understand about Republicans and just not to underestimate them at any point, about how they would rather order the code red on the economy, basically, then give Democrats a win in terms of legislation. So this was what the Obama administration, which Biden was obviously a part of, we can get to that as well, what they constantly underestimated. They thought they were dealing with people that cared about America, to be blunt. And really what the reality is that Republicans were very willing to implement austerity measures and stand firm on very little spending in order to slow economic growth under under a Democratic president. That's an actual dynamic. Can you expand on that, and if that dynamic still prevails in a post-Trump Republican Party?
Yeah, I mean, there were certainly some sort of economic reasons why Republicans opposed the stimulus measure in 2009, but the reason why they voted against it was politically. They thought they wanted Obama to be a one-term president. They wanted him to own economic collapse that was largely, you know, the result of the economic and fiscal policy making of the Bush administration. Mitch McConnell was very open about this, and yet he got away with it completely. Voters didn't punish him for it. The Obama administration, I think, tried a little bit to punish him for it and failed. And the media at the time bought it all up. They loved this idea of, you know, small government conservatism making a comeback, even though it was being done literally to hold, you know, the American economy at gunpoint. So what, you know, what we're seeing now, I think, is another version of that. You can look just a few months ago, and Republicans were, you know, passing, you know, $2-3 trillion legislation to, you know, work on the economy because, you know, they were dependent on Donald Trump getting reelected. You know, there were also downstream effects of that. You saw this again right before the sort of Georgia runoffs. I think Mitch McConnell was already thinking that, you know, Donald Trump was the lost cause, but to try to hold on to those seats, you know, they passed a bill with $600 checks. That was a compromise, but still it was a huge, you know, multi-hundred-billion-dollar bill. And now, you know, you get to this point where Republicans are saying, well, we already spent all this money, so why should we spend more now? But that's not really the argument that they're making. It's not really the calculus that's behind that argument. They don't want to do more stimulus, even though the economy obviously needs it, even though I think the consequences of doing so, despite what Larry Summers might say, I think seem to be quite small. They're doing it because they want to damage the Biden administration politically, particularly at this, you know, very early stage.
Two more questions. This wasn't touched on in your piece, but I'm curious about your thoughts, because I'm trying to draw a comparison between, say, Lieberman, who is kind of the standard bearer. Yeah, like, God, I don't like thinking about him, of centrism and austerity in the Democratic Party, or really whatever, in that area, back in the Obama years. And I guess Manchin is kind of becoming that figure right now, Joe Manchin of West Virginia. And I much would rather deal with Joe Manchin, and my case is that Lieberman represented the insurance industry, he represented Wall Street, and there's only one end to, there's only one goal for him, right, which is to protect those industries, and there's only one avenue to get there, really, which is to make sure that you limit the amount of penalties that Wall Street would have to undergo, or the amount, and make sure that health insurance is still private, all those things. Manchin, on the other hand, is participating in basically a branding exercise where he wants to appear like a maverick so he can vote against Neera Tanden, but then also potentially vote for Biden's stimulus package. It's a lot more malleable. Can you talk about the difference in that dynamic as well, where, you know, I guess the figurehead for the furthest right Democrat, is a very different person, I think, than back in the early Obama years.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one difference too is that, which is, I think is worth underlining, is just that the Obama administration had 60 Democrats, which seems much better, but actually like herding cats, because you basically knew at any one point, you know, that was the filibuster threshold, that, you know, one person could hold the whole thing hostage, whereas with 50 Democrats, it's ironically a little easier, even though the same dynamic is there. They sort of know that things are much tighter. You don't get people who are kind of asking for crazy stuff at the last minute. But I think the point that you're making is really, really important, which is that the sort of corporate Democrats, particularly like Lieberman of the old variety, were interested in keeping the sort of, you know, it, one, I think keeping the image of themselves as being conservative Democrats of sort of working for the status quo, of not, you know, being part of big government or whatever. But, you know, what they wanted to do was to secure big bailouts for companies that didn't need them, who in many cases were responsible for the actual economic crisis that we were in at that time. Manchin is a very interesting figure, but he is in some ways an older type of Democrat. He, you know, is a guy who wants bridges in his state. He wants money in West Virginia. You know, if there's there, I'm sure there'll be like a, you know, Joe Manchin esports trauma recovery wing in some stimulus bill at some point, just because that's the kind of stuff that he likes. And that, I think, makes dealing with Manchin in many ways a lot easier. I think Neera Tanden obviously gets to be the sacrificial lamb in this instance, where he gets to perform that he's not, you know, your standard Democrat. He is voting against the mean tweets lady. But at the same time, you know, and West Virginia's Republican governor has also pushed the same kind of thing. These are people who I think really, you know, want the federal government to step in up to a certain point, or at least, you know, fire the money hose at West Virginia.
Yeah. I mean, there's a very huge difference than being the senator from Connecticut, where there is a ton of health insurance money, and being the senator from West Virginia. I mean, coal is obviously a nefarious industry in and of itself, but for our purposes, this is, it's a lot easier to deal with Manchin. So, last question. What do you think this means for when we get past COVID, if that time ever happens? Hopefully it does. What do you think this means for the rest of Biden's term in terms of how the media, like, will the media still hold the Republicans accountable after the after effects of Trump, or the shockwaves of Trump, wear off? Like, will we see this continued skepticism of Republicans, the skepticism, and I guess in my case, disdain, but at the very least, the skepticism that their claims deserve.
I think that the sense that I get from the sort of Beltway press in particular is a sort of real desperation to believe in any form of Republican governance, that if anyone can, you know, emerge and claim that mantle, then they'll just be showered with adoration and positive attention. At the same time, though, I think what we have seen over the last, accelerated significantly over the last 3 or 4 months, is the sense of media members waking up to the fact that, you know, the old small C, you know, Reagan coalition, like, isn't coming back, that there aren't going to be respectable Republicans who, I think, even though those policies were based on, you know, in my opinion, really abhorrent ideas about the poor and about minorities in particular, that they could always be glossed over with this kind of, you know, these kind of ideological arguments or economic arguments. And I think what we've seen again and again is, you know, Republican voters, Republican politicians are not animated by tax rates, right? They're not animated by the size of the federal government. They want to see Democrats punished, right? That comes from the QAnon wing, but I think also it comes from just the sort of basic, you know, the basic, whatever, meat and potatoes Republican voter at this point is not interested in even kind of abstract Republican ideas. What they want are, you know, red-blooded culture war politics. And the Beltway press in particular is not equipped to handle that at all, because it's a both sides industry, right? They won't tell people what the truth is. They won't tell people what's actually happening. What they want to tell them are a red guy says X and a blue guy says Y. So I think, you know, we still haven't gotten to a point where, you know, people at sort of mainstream outlets have figured out how to cover that. But I don't think you can go back to the way it was.
Hopefully not. Alex Shepard of The New Republic, his piece is entitled "No One's Buying the Republicans' Deficit Fearmongering Anymore." Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Are you still subscribed to the free show? Well, head over to ROFpodcast.com and support this show by becoming a member. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm. My daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day and featuring an in-depth interview like 2 or 3 times a week, ladies and gentlemen. For Emma Vigeland, Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.